Hello, my name is Tim Flitcroft, and I'm part of one of the organisers of Common Horizons for the meeting on January the 27th. And I'm talking to Julie Timbrell, who has been involved in a housing group in London. And we're going to be talking about how that got set up and the history of it, the problems that they faced, because they worked as a commons. In how they survived as a group. And so we're going to be discussing that now. Okay, Julie, hi.
Hi.
Can you just give us a background? I mean, what sort of condition, how did you meet and what condition were the houses in and who did they belong to when you first started?
Okay, yeah. It's a housing cooperative, and it's based in London. And I first got involved through spotting my house in when I was about 19 years old, and so there it was. All my streets and an adjacent street was squatted, and we were a community. And then at some point we decided to look around for a little bit more security, and we ended up joining a slightly we formed our first of all we formed a housing cooperative, and then we decided that it would be in our best interest to look around for a different housing cooperative. And so we joined a larger one, which was also really composed of lots of sort of smaller squatted communities that had come together into a bigger community. And that was about 30 years ago now.
Were you paying some form of rent to the housing co-op in order to sort of manage the properties, or how did that work?
Yeah, so when we started out, when we started out, obviously we were squatting, and then when we joined up with the other larger cooperative, we started to license our houses from the council. And so we were paying like quite small amounts of rent at that point, and the houses were kept in what was called short life standards. So anyway, we already had this real DIY spirit. So when we'd moved into our houses, they were like often in complete disrepair. So me and some friends put in a new toilet and dug into the drains here, and we sort of fixed our roofs, and we did all kinds of different things. So when we joined and we got a license, we had to pay. I think it was £25 a week, which was a bit that would be a bit more now, but it was still really quite cheap. And the houses were kept in like basic standards. When we joined, we did actually get our roofs done, and we've got a bit more work for a grant system. So yeah, that's how it started. And then as a housing cooperative, it progressed, and we decided at some point to start saving up to buy our houses from the council. We did that, and then we managed to negotiate to buy the houses from the council. So we own the freehold for the houses, which was actually quite a smart move to do that. So we got them at a discount. So collectively, at that time it was more like 60, 70 houses, and now it's about 50 houses.
Can I
And then
just,
with that, yeah.
there's just two details because not everyone will be familiar with how housing works in London. So can you say a little bit more about two aspects? One is the short life licenses with the council, because these are all council properties, they're council property owned
Yeah.
properties. So you got a license to just stay in them, but the council
Yeah.
didn't take any responsibility for them, but
Exactly, yeah.
you stayed in them self-administering your the looking
Yeah.
after. So at that point, when the two co-ops joined up, and say you had a problem like a blocked lavatory or drains getting blocked or roofs getting holes in them, who did the repairs? Did you have a repair team, or did you the houses do it?
So yeah, no. By the time we joined up with the housing cooperative, that we would have someone who would come out and do repairs, but it would sort of be like really basic ones. Yeah, no. If we did get a blocked drain, or like if the roofs were like leaking, But everything else, the culture was pretty much we would do it ourselves, and it was, you know, everything was quite basic, basically.
So in this period, were you having meetings communally to make decisions? I mean, like when you joined the larger housing co-op group, I mean, were you having meetings right from the beginning, and how were they run? You know, when you first started off, can you talk a bit about how the meetings were organised from the start?
So we did have meetings right from the very start on the street. I think several of them were in each other's in our houses, basically in our living rooms. And we did set it up formally. So we did register as a housing cooperative. I think we were called Keith Robinson, and after the artist. And we had a secretary, but it was sort of all quite free at that time. It was a real sort of squatted sort of anarchist artist sort of vibe going on. So there were minutes and stuff like that, but it was pretty much us all talking about things.
Did you have to come to a situation where you had to vote? I mean, how did you handle that? If you were there any situations where there were sort of disagreements and at that point in the history of it, I mean did you use consensus or did you just vote? Or
I can't really remember ever voting. I remember that we had like a really key decision, which was we went and visited three different housing sort of organizations to potentially join up with. One of them was really big and really organized, but quite sort of like it was a big organization. And then one was really small and was sort of quite dynamic, but it felt like it was quite sort of risky. Potentially, we'd have to have done quite a lot. And then one was like a medium one, and we went with the medium one. So I remember talking about that quite a lot. And then I suppose one of the other things was that some people just did not want to regularise their situation. Like I did. Particularly because I had a daughter, I was a single parent, and other people in that same situation. So I think some of us were just more motivated for security, for maybe because we had responsibilities, or we were just more orientated towards it anyway. But then some people really weren't. Some people just wanted to maintain that sort of more free anarchistic thing. That's how they saw, that's what they liked, the benefits of squatting. And then some people actually had like a deal where they weren't quite in the same situation. So they were paying like £1 a week to an organisation. So all I remember was a discussions about people's different values and bit different situations. And then like at one point, some people also had, there's a kind of adverse possession thing. So if you're in the house for like a certain, for 10 years, I think they've changed this law now, that you can get adverse possession.
Mm-hmm.
So some people also in the situation where they thought they might be able to get adverse possession. So I do remember having like quite long sort of conversations with two people in that situation. I was taking quite a leadership role then, and I was also having discussions with the person in the council about grants and stuff like that that we might be able to access, and sort of doing quite a lot of the sort of negotiation. So in terms of those two houses with adverse possession, one person decided they thought that they probably weren't going to get it, and they came with us. And then the other one, I sort of had to play a bit delicate because I had some paperwork which would support her legal case about the adverse possession, but we wanted to work as a group in terms of the council. So that was a sort of like balancing act. In the end, she got a payoff from the council. So she didn't keep the house, but she got quite a significant sum. She was happy with that. Oh, because it was a bit complicated because some of the houses the council wanted to negotiate. It's all coming back to me, sorry Tim. So some of the houses, the council wanted us to give up this group of houses so that they could develop it, and they built a social centre in the end. So part of the negotiations is that we, so one of those persons got paid off, some other people combined a household and moved in together, and then someone, we negotiated a house that was half burnt down for another family to move into. So actually it was sort of trying to meet everybody's needs in terms of the housing, how whole housing cooperative. I don't ever remember it coming to a vote. I don't think we were sort of in that culture. I just remember us sort of negotiating different things and trying to find a way through. And I felt like at the end of the day, everybody, like people made different choices. So we didn't all stay together and do the same thing. But I felt like as a community, we probably all were okay with what happened.
So I think we should just mention for people who don't know about adverse possession, that is, if in England there's a law that if you remain in a property and I think the ownership isn't challenged for a period of 10 years, then you acquire the right to the freehold, I believe, of the property. Although it can have complexities. I know there was one in South London where they'd won it, but they didn't have it to the actual entrance. The garden gets it, so they sort of were in a peculiar position. They had to kind of jump over it. Well, there was some really weird. There's some very strange laws in England, and that was one where the adverse possession can be. But I do remember that phase of squatting, where everyone was kind of, oh, God, I could get adverse possession, you know. And there were some big problems we talked about.
Like horizon, wasn't it? Oh my gosh, I could get this house. Really, could be mine. So yeah.
I think we should also mention the background to this whole thing, because I was squatting from the 70s, I was initially in Kentish Town, was just that, you know, really there's a huge amount of council housing that the councils couldn't afford to do up. So there was just all this rotting housing left alone. It was initially started off squatting in England by troops returning who were dispossessed, didn't have anywhere to live. There's also squatting going on in those, you know, those things that were built basically as temporary shelters in the East End. I knew a lot of people who were living in those. I mean, they were designed just to be as temporary shelters, but they were squatted for some, I mean, like 50 years after the event, you know, they were still being squatted. So it was a very peculiar situation in England. And it also evolved around, so a lot of areas were bombed out. So there'd be streets that were kind of in quite a weird situation with half the street sort of properly and the other half looking sort of like, you know, so it's from a completely different era and so forth, things like this. So
that was the situation down our street, so that's why that half, there was like a row of streets and then it would be bombed and then five houses there, so that was the five houses that they wanted to sort of knock down and then build this social centre. And yeah, totally, our houses were like had been abandoned. So council tenants used to leave or get rehoused, and then we used to sort of move in. And when I was studying art, I discovered that actually all the rows sort of above my street at one point had been this like alternative 1970s cultural centre, women's centre, and all those kind of things going on. So yeah, it was totally like us using squatting, like the waste. The way it was at that point, it was a waste. Like it had just been abandoned, and we were sort of making goo. And we had that sort of pioneering spirit, and it was great. And and then like it's incredible because these houses, when occasionally they come up on the market and they get sold for like £7,000. One of them got sold at that time, and now they're getting sold for like nearly, I don't know, 750,000 or something like that.
Can I ask you two things? I'll ask them both at the same time so you can flip. One is, did you build any kind of social centres yourselves as a group? And the other thing I want to ask you about was just to go back to that challenge you faced with people having different aspirations, particularly between those who wanted security and those who wanted to have a more kind of less responsible, more freewheeling kind of relationship to their housing. I'd be interested if you could talk about those two things.
So in terms of social centres, I think our sort of social centres only really got as far as organising some pretty good parties. But we were networked into things like Cooltown Arts in Brixton.
Oh, right.
And so several of us were involved in that, and we would sort of, you know, those who were into that kind of thing would meet down there and get involved in things like that. So, and then there was also some art studios as well. So several people were practicing artists or studying art and things like that. So we were, there was, I can't remember the names of them now, but there was a sort of series of studios that we were sort of networked into as well. So, and then there was like a neighborhood as well where it had things like, there was a sort of neighborhood street that had like a shops and things like that. And then there was a cafe, actually, come to think of it, there was a really good cafe. And
you had your own cafe.
Well, it wasn't our own, exactly our own, but I think it sort of came from the community, and then it went legal, and then it went sort of, and then it just went up and up and up in terms of its, at one point it was all sort of like cool music and like hippie food, and then it went sort of like, it went through these iterations until by the end of it was called something like High Society, and it had bouncing outside. so you just recognize it for the end. But actually, ironically, now it's been shut down because it got so quite popular with young people, it became a nightclub, and then the locals complained about it, so now it's actually occupied by some guardians, which is sort of like the modern version squatting.
That's a very interesting thing you're talking about, it because these kind of histories, I don't know how much they're shared around Europe. It would be very interesting to hear in the discussion how much was, but what you're describing is very much like, do you know the Bonnington Square squat?
Yeah,
they had a cafe, and they had lots of events and things.
Yeah, so we're sort of quite fairly close to Bonnington Square as well, so that was definitely, like, if you think of like our network community, that I would say that was part of our network community at that point. And this was continuous, this is contemporary with the Bonnington Square Cafe that started. Yeah. So definitely,
So how did it all work out between the anarchists and the security minded people? How did you kind of work that out? Did some people leave because they couldn't handle the wave? I mean, how did the co-op basically go? Did it go towards security by the sound of it?
It did. It went towards security. So there was two households didn't join in because they wanted to stay with their £1 a week deal with like a big housing cooperative, and they just, you know, that was fine. And then there was one person who was definitely sort of ideologically sort of more, or sort of personally more committed to the sort of more anarchistic lifestyle. He sort of left, and he went to Israel for a bit, maybe to Kibbutz, and they went to Bristol and stuff like that. But I think it all sort of like fitted in with various, I think a sort of relationship was ending as well that he had. But none of it felt like unharmonious. I sort of just felt like, it just felt like, oh, that's that's just sort of like a parting of the ways. I don't remember it ever feeling sort of bitter or anything like that.
Sure, I think I can understand that. That's how it felt to me. So the story is then that from these squatting beginnings, you became a housing co-op. And then the other bit of the story I'm very interested in is, how did you create the legal entity that was able to buy a set of houses cooperatively, and how did the council treat you, and how, just that bit of the story sounds very interesting too.
So when we formed like a local housing cooperative, we actually became like formed a housing cooperative, but then when we joined the existing housing, like this bigger housing cooperative, we dissolved our legal structure and joined their legal structure. But their legal structure was probably similar to our legal structure. It was like a fully mutual housing cooperative. Although I've been very much embedded in the sort of former, the sort of smaller one, the bigger one, there was already quite a lot of people involved in that. And I think I was on the committee for a bit, but mainly I just used to go along to the general meetings that we used to have sort of every now and again. And my understanding of it is that at one point there had been quite sort of there was a lot of squatting in Lambeth, and there was a tension and a conflict between the council, who then decided, well, although this sort of people taking over the abandoned houses had suited the council at one point, things were shifting, property prices were going up, housing needs were going up, all those kind of things. And so then the council wasn't so happy with all their short life, and they more wanted potentially the houses back, because either this was a lot of capital that they had invested, and or they could then either do up for other people or sell and realize. So then there became like a sort of squatted movement versus the council movement. And then at some point, I think our housing cooperative, with the leadership of a director who we had employed, who I think had been actually one of the members of the housing cooperative, but his position, he was already in position by the time our cooperative joined that housing cooperative. He and that committee decided to, rather than take a sort of adversarial role to the council, we're trying to shift tactics and position themselves so that we could actually buy those houses. And so then we set about a strategy of like paying more rent. So our rents doubled so we could save that money. And also our positioning with the council became more diplomatic in terms of building up relationships as well.
That's interesting.
So
what date was that? What date was that when you started saving money to buy?
I think it was probably in the 90s. We've owned the houses for about 15 years, maybe 17 years. And so I think it was about five, it was a few years before that, maybe three, maybe five, maybe seven, maybe about five I have in my mind. So it could have been like, but it was a good few years that we started saving up. So maybe it was like 20, 25 years ago, something like that.
How many years would you say you were saving?
For a few years. Yeah.
Did you get a mortgage in order to acquire the?
Yeah, so we got a mortgage, but we also, by that point, the properties were like really expensive. So
yes,
we still had to negotiate a discount, like a big discount from the council.
Right.
And so the agreement was that we would, I think we bought them for about 10% of the sort of market value at that point.
10%?
I think it was about 10%.
That's incredibly low.
It could have been higher, but I think it was about 10%. And then we also made an agreement with the council that we would rehouse people from the council list. So when houses became available, we would rehouse them. So from the council's perspective, when we're taking responsibility for some houses which were in very poor condition, and we're rehousing people from the housing list. So I think, you know, it's, you know, although it's low, you could say actually that housing was bequeathed to Lambeth for social housing. So it's not like they're actually giving us that value. It's like we are caretaking that value for the bigger purpose that it was already bequeathed to Lambeth for. So we're Max. So I sort of look at it in that way, really.
So in terms of people on the waiting list, the council waiting list, I mean, they're normally in families, aren't they? And you're basically single. Fundamentally single, are you in your group, or are you families as well?
At that point, I came as a family. Many of us came families. We're sort of a growing older housing cooperative, so some of us are families, some of our families are grown up now, some of us are single. Like, it's a mix, yeah.
And have you had any what's the experience of integrating people from the council waiting list, or has that not arisen as yet?
So there's a little bit further in the story, but maybe we won't jump ahead. So I'd say it's something Some people have got involved, but not so much. Like, and that's something we do need to do a little bit. We sort of identified as work we need to do more on. Really.
You mean by that people who've come in off the waiting list have come into our community, and they've not really sort of become part of the community. They've just sort of stayed more or less like council tenants.
Well, I suppose it's things like, well, how you define the community, isn't it? So it's sort of like there's a community as in like turning up to meetings, and then there's a community like mixing on your streets. I don't know whether I'm trying to think. I'm not aware that we've had some people who have engaged in the meetings. We've had some people that have pitched up and then they haven't sort of quite known what's going on, and then we sort of missed the moment with them a bit. That's something we sort of really need to get better at. I don't know how much people, because in my particular street, we haven't had anybody reach out from the council, so I don't really know how much that's sort of integrated on the community level. I do know some people have been involved in the running, but not so many. There was one person there, and someone I've sort of really tried to get involved, because actually we've got a real problem as well, because some of the people who do come in, we've been trying to get and think about the people who come into our housing tend to have younger people involved. So actually it's really crucial now that we do get them involved. And so we've also now realised of late that we don't have to house just the council as well. We re-looked at our agreement and we've realised that we can actually house from other housing cooperatives. And of late, we've done that as well. So we've been trying to build up relationships with sister housing cooperatives to get younger. So that's quite often being younger families, and we want to try and get that mix of council tenants, which we do a better induction with, and then sort of like families who may come from a similar short life sort of setup, or maybe, you know, so we want to try and get a more diverse group, because we're very aware that we're quite an aging population.
Yeah, I can imagine that. So are there any other, are there any updates to add to the story, or any other sort of challenges you see in how things progressed or how they are now?
Well, yeah, I think it was like I said that the director had been quite pivotal to sort of us saving up. He'd been very business minded, and he'd been definitely quite a strong leader in terms of the housing cooperative. We were sort of probably a bit like sort of herding cats, but at some point him and a group in the management committee had decided to be sort of like quite focused on this getting our houses, which in lots of ways had been really good, because we ended up in this fortuitous situation through their planning that we do on our houses, and that's actually fairly unusual. Lots of the other cooperatives I meet don't own the freehold of their houses. They sort of license it from other people. And so it does give us much more autonomy over what we do. But the sort of legacy of that group and that director coming together it felt at some stage that group hadn't really changed much. And then so when new people were popping up with new ideas, there was a fair amount of resistance to that. And so then there was a change process where more people got involved, and also as other people who maybe were sort of my generation, which is a bit younger, believe it or not, and a few other people had sort of developed in their professional careers as well, and started to want to come up with some different ideas, like doing risk assessments or sort of re-looking at our governance and things like that. And so when we joined the committee, we wanted to change things and actually get more involved and leave less to the director. And that sort of led to a change process, And in the end, the director left, and we then joined up. We decided to then link in with this London-wide housing cooperative who were providing some services and some expertise. And that's when we started to link in with other small housing cooperatives to share our allocations, and just got a little bit of a broader perspective and more joined up with the rest of the cooperative movement. And then took on more responsibilities as a management committee. And we formed different groups to look into repairs and to look into staffing. And to, so there's been a bit of a sort of revival in over the last few years of people sort of stepping up, which has been quite good.
So would I be, to sum it up, would I say that when you were kind of still a housing co-op paying very low rents and there was a lot of divergency of interests and ambitions and aims in people, it wasn't, you weren't really coordinated enough. And then did you pay this director or was he voluntary?
Was paid. I would say that we were younger and maybe less professionally experienced, and maybe I suppose our perceptions of getting things, yeah. So I think, and there were divergences as well. So I think there was a lot, there was a point where a lot ended up being delegated to him, to a small committee, and then to him.
So you went through a process where you sort of became more vertical in a way. I mean, there was kind of more,
definitely,
a focused vertical group, and then you kind of changed that again, and you reverted back to a more horizontal group, which is fascinating. So you started off sort of ultra horizontal and anarchistic, and you gradually grew more organized. Then you sort of changed into a professionally appointed sort of vertical structure, and then you dissolved that, and you've gone back now to an increasingly horizontal. Would that be a fair picture of the history?
I say we probably went. We were sort of, I'd say, definitely anarchistic and a bit of sort of slightly messy. Then definitely vertical, quite very vertical and a bit rigid, but sort of like, yeah. And now I'd say we've gone to like, okay, well, let's try and sort of both upgrade our governance and like have more in the committee. So like maybe, say, actually the decision making is more in the committee rather than in the one staff member. So like more horizontal in that way, and now I think we're trying to get even more horizontal, and we're trying to get more people involved in the wider housing cooperative, and we sort of like put out an encouraging letter, and it's a bit difficult with the pandemic. We'd like to have sort of like Christmas meetings and like, you know, picnics and stuff like that, but that's sort of hard. So I'd say that we are definitely going more sort of horizontal, but in a more organized way. I think it was more because the squatting thing, I think, was always my perception of the squatting thing was always quite cultural. You know, it was a lot about the sort of parties and the lifestyle. And it was like, whereas I came to when I joined more recently the housing cooperative, and I was the chair for the last sort of 3 years, I also came with a perspective of both my professional role, which is in local government in democracy, and also my experience in the commons. So I come with more of a deliberate wanting to build a commons with certain, hopefully skills, but certain ideas which are sort of related to anarchism, but more sort of democratic anarchism, which was whereas I felt when I was younger it was more sort of cultural anarchism.
All right, it's an interesting distinction. So do you have paid workers still?
So we have one paid worker still, yeah, we do. And then we have this cooperative, this organization that was just created actually by squatting housing, by housing co-ops, to provide certain services. So they do things like they help us with our governance, they help us with our policies, they do our refurbishment program.
Oh, that's an external group.
It's an external group, yeah.
That manage you in a sense.
Well, they don't manage us. No, it's definitely they do management services, but it's we commission them. So right. Yeah,
so sort of outsourcing elements of management.
But they were set up. I mean, they were set up by a housing cooperative, someone who was a leading like in housing cooperative. They've gone on a bit of a journey and they're a bit more corporate. So they then are sort of like an adjunct to a really huge organisation. But they're still very focused on delivering cooperative services. And we've tried, it's been a sort of balancing it sort of act, because they are very strong, very professional, and but we've been quite keen to keep our that we don't just sort of go, oh, okay, you're the professional, come in and sort us all out, you know, because we've sort of been down that tack. But at the same time, they do bring like lots of skills. Like they bring this knowledge about policy, they bring refurbishment, which is quite hard in a small organization to have all those skills. So, but we want to stay in the driving seat as well. So we've also done something, we've also appointed a treasurer who is actually skilled in accountants. He's a retired accountant.
Is that a paid position?
Or? We pay him, but he's on the board. And that actually has been quite good in terms of, he brings that professional expertise, but he's not part of that organisation. So that gives us a certain amount of expertise to counterbalance their sort of their professionalism as well. And So it's a sort of delicate balancing act, really.
Julie, I think it's a really fascinating story, and I've been in a much, I've in my co-op experience has been, I think, far less successful than yours. I mean, I was in ICH, Islington Community Housing, and also Camden Community Housing. Piers Corbyn was in that at the time, in Bassett Street, and we didn't get, I think what you've managed to achieve is a great degree of self-management, kind of really responsible self-management, and you've been quite flexible, and you kept on changing tax. And I think it's a real achievement to actually buy the properties and retain control, because in our case, we were just bought out by a big housing cooperative who bought it from the council, and then they'd be more or less like diktats, and we don't have that kind of, I think that's very interesting what you said at the latter bit about having a kind of relationship with a housing co-op management, or sort of doing management services across other co-ops that understand how it is to be in a co-op. But we just ended up as in, also when we were moved into the housing, they wouldn't let us live communally anymore, because they said legally you couldn't own a house. You couldn't rent you as a communal group. So all our histories of communal living, which went back for years, I mean decades, were just ended, and we all are living now in individual sliced up bits of Victorian houses, which I didn't want. I didn't vote for it, but there were, and it's quite interesting to reflect the different experiences that a lot of people didn't want any more the communal experience, particularly women who felt that they sort of unfairly shared some of the tasks of the kind of communal domestic jobs being done. And there's a very strong voice amongst women in the group that they wanted actually just to have their own space. They didn't want the difficulties of sharing bathrooms and kitchens. So I was overruled because I liked communal living. So we've all ended up in our little cells, really, it feels like. And the conversions have been done at very low quality, extremely low quality. But, you know, I'm still in the same street and still have in a beautiful area, so there's good things. But the communal spirit's been broken. And in fact, if there's a communal spirit at all now, it's just within people who live on the street generally, not particularly within the co-op, although the co-op members do sort of nod to each other, kind of, you know, in a kind of, I guess there's an extra layer of community a bit, but it's not really what you experience at all. And I think what you've managed to do is great. You know, we better leave that there, because we've done a fantastically long interview. just because I'm so personally interested in it. So I'm going to I'm going to stop the recording now. So anyone who's listening, thanks for listening. Sorry if it was a huge long journey, but these histories are really worth. And I'm sorry, in fact, there was much more juicier detail we couldn't get into, but at least you got an idea of the joys and travails of living on the margins in London in the 80s, well, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and now. Okay, Julie, thanks a lot for telling us about your experiences. Take care now. Bye. Bye.
Bye.